Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. This hour on the program, in the Middle East, Israeli ground forces continue their incursion into Gaza. Hamas continues to fire rockets into southern Israel. In Afghanistan, 127 American soldiers were killed in combat in 2008, and the Pentagon plans to send more than 20,000 extra troops to that country in the next 12 to 18 months. Also, the U.S. has handed over control of security in Baghdad's Green Zone to Iraqi forces as part of continuing steps to reduce the U.S. presence in Iraq. We'll explore these and other challenges for U.S. foreign and security policy. Back with us, John Mueller holds the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at OSU's Mershon Center and is professor of political science here. My guest's current book is Overblown: How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. Welcome back, John Mueller. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We're at 614-292-8513, or you can email brief comments to openline at wosu.org or questions. John, we have the Israeli attack and response pattern and continuing. Hamas, over the preceding months, lobbing rockets into southern Israel. Now Israel, ground action in Gaza, attempting what? What are the goals here?
Well, that's one of your better questions, I must say. I don't know. The Israelis are exercised over these rockets that have been rained down over several months in Israel. And so they want to go take them out, which is perfectly understandable. But what everybody keeps saying is, what's the end game? And I'd really like to see what the answer to that is, too. They can obviously do a fair amount of damage. They can cramp Hamas's style, but they're also creating a large number of people who are even more hostile than they were before. So the idea that there's no way, except by occupying Gaza, which they apparently don't want to do, that they can really control the situation. Mm-hmm. And so eventually some, even if it's a tiny, tiny minority of the Palestinians there, will get rockets. And since they obviously cause so much heartache within Israel, they'll see a real advantage in lobbing some more, I would imagine, in due course.
Mm-hmm. So short of occupying Gaza with Israeli troops, which one would guess the Israeli public would not support, when the troops leave, after a certain interval, as you see, even if it's a very small minority that would like to lob rockets, they'll smuggle them in and they'll start again.
That's what I would assume. You could also imagine it happening from the West Bank. Why not? So it just seems to be the concern in Israel is obviously totally understandable. I mean, as Barack Obama put it, somebody's bombing my children. You know, I care a lot, of course. Perfectly understandable. It's just that it's not clear how you solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it just seems hopeless.
Hopeless.
Yeah. And one of the things that's odd about this, everybody's trying to say, what should the United States do and so forth about it. And no one basically says, how about nothing? I mean, there's nothing you can do. Obviously, the Arabs and Israelis start getting their act together, and there's real progress. You would think the West and the United States would be there first with trying to do everything it could to, you know, facilitate things. But until that happens, it's not clear that anybody outside, for that matter, can do much of anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Bush administration has followed that policy, right?
Bush, you know, is going to solve the whole thing by the time he left office. So we've got another week and a half. So I'm sure he's going to be really busy working in solving that problem.
Yeah. So in terms of looking at policy options for the incoming Obama administration with regard to Israel and Palestinians, there aren't many, are you suggesting?
I'd say give the hell up.
Give up.
Yeah, it's hopeless.
That's pretty tough for an incoming president to hear advice like that. To give up and simply just...
Well, if he wants, you know, he comes in saying he wants to hear all this kind of advice. And one thing he should hear, he obviously won't accept that advice, but he should hear that. I've been looking at a lot of foreign policy, you know, over the Cold War and so forth. There's lots of times when clear policy options like that were not even expressed. In other words, they were not examined, said, no, we can't possibly do that and go into something else, which is perfectly reasonable, obviously. You have to make choices. But it wasn't even on the choice. It wasn't even in the option palette.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think some of the advice, other than doing nothing, Barack Obama will be getting? What do you think that will be from associates?
Well, work on a two-state solution, a one-state solution, a three-state solution, a 12-state solution. You know, talk to the Israelis about giving up some of the settlements, you know, trying to internationalize Jerusalem or something like that, trying to get a stable Palestinian authority on both sides. And, I mean, there's been – I haven't made an exact count, But I would suspect there's been about 483,000 surefire plans for peace in that area, and mm-hmm. they all sound the same.
Yeah.
And so I suppose you could add another 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 or 300,000 more.
So you're really saying every option has been explored to no effect?
Yeah. The options, everybody knows what the answer is.
Yeah.
I mean, people have been saying this for 50 years.
And what is that?
It's a two-state solution with a stable Palestinian Authority, with some trade swap on land, so that Israel gives up some land and gets to keep some land where they get settlements now. And then with Jerusalem, some sort of internationalization of it, with religious areas, obviously, you know, carefully preserved for the various groups, but with probably de facto Israeli control. And also some sort of token right of return, you know, some Arabs who get to come back from 1949 so, mm-hmm. as a way of sort of, you know, something.
And compensation for others who
yeah,
might
maybe
not
some
want
compensation.
Return, but, yeah.
Yeah.
So everybody knows what the answer is. The question is nobody knows remotely how to get there.
Yeah.
Even the first steps to take. I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this question, if this current situation of Hamas lobbing rockets indiscriminately into civilian areas in southern Israel over the past numbers of months, if this could have been – and the questionable results of an Israeli ground invasion, as you say, a few months later the rockets could come again. I wonder if there were any way of negotiating this out in advance, or is Hamas simply too extreme?
Well, it's not, you know, you got sort of a eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth and revenge sort of thing going on there. And, you know, that's one of the lessons of Spielberg's film Munich, that it doesn't stop then, right? I mean, it's like this blood feud, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. And there doesn't seem to be a way to break the chain. I mean, one of the key things is, from the Israeli standpoint, is having a serious discussion about abandoning settlements. And that doesn't, you know, they tried some, they did get out of Gaza, but they tried some very limited stuff in the West Bank of taking out outposts, which everybody thinks is illegal, including the Israelis, and had a big political flak over that. And they're, you know, it just doesn't seem to be within their capabilities mm-hmm. and the present circumstances.
Now, the leader of Hamas has said numerous times, in fact, very recently to the editor of the New Yorker magazine, that Israel has no right to exist and that as far as they're concerned, any truce or any ceasefire for any length of time is merely a prelude to some sort of move to drive Israelis into the sea, in essence.
Well, it's to get rid of the state of Israel.
Get rid of it, yeah.
Not necessarily the Jews of Israel. Mm-hmm. In other words, the issue that they would potentially stay. In other words, it's not Holocaust in that sense.
Yeah.
It's that they regard the state of Israel as being illegitimate.
No more Jewish state.
No more Jewish state,
in his
right.
opinion. But are all elements...
Which is existential, obviously, from that standpoint. From
yeah.
But it doesn't mean people die.
Yeah.
Everybody dies.
What? But are there other elements of Hamas that are not so extreme with whom Israel could negotiate?
Yeah, I guess so. You keep getting these reports about various things, plus the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah. And the other end has obviously got much more reasonable people in various places. And apparently the Damascus wing of Hamas is a lot more moderate than the one in the West Bank, or rather in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, and the same with, you know, Taliban, for that matter. You know, that there's clear deals you can possibly strike with some of them, but you have to be willing to do it. And there's no guarantee it'll work either, however.
I must say, none of the Middle East experts I've had on the show in recent years have been very optimistic about the situation, been quite rather pessimistic. In fact.
Yeah. Well, I have the courage of their pessimism.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, the logic – I've listened to these talks all the time, and I've frequently said, why don't we just give up? I mean, it's the logic of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a very pleasant conclusion.
Sure.
But they never are willing to – bite that particular bullet. It
sure.
seems to be perfectly reasonable, if unpleasant.
John Mueller is professor of political science here at The Ohio State University. 614-292-8513. Let's go to our caller, Jerry. Hello, Jerry.
Good morning. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Jerry, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to say a couple, three things and then ask the professor where you can get good, accurate information. Last night on the News Hour, Mark Perry stated that the Israelis had violated the treaty 153 times, and the opposite fellow from him forget his name, he didn't contradict that. And then the other night I saw Christiane Amanpour, you know who she is.
Yeah, right. Sure.
And a very respected reporter.
CNN, yeah.
Said essentially, she didn't say the number, but she said essentially the same thing. And yet, on most of your cable net, most of your cable networks, and obviously on ABC, CBS, and NBC, all you see are the bad things against one side and the good things against the other. And then I heard last night that a bomb hit and knocked out a family of seven, I think two, husband and wife and five children in the Gaza Strip, so-called. And I question, in fact, I have a friend who knows a man in Ireland, and he was talking to him this last week, and the man in Ireland said, you people aren't getting anything of the facts that are going on over there. And, Professor, I'll hang up, and I don't know, you don't know where to turn.
For accurate information.
And
understand. So the John, our caller is implying that U.S. media are biased toward Israel. But I did see, if you read the New York Times this morning, a long report on civilian casualties in Gaza, including a photograph of a Palestinian father mourning his three dead young sons. I mean, the photograph of that. And so I wonder, what would you suggest if our caller wants accurate information?
Well, the web, I mean, British newspapers probably are a good place to get it, maybe Irish newspapers as well. So you get a somewhat broader perspective than the BBC and so forth. There was a study in international security a few years ago, about 2 years ago, comparing New York Times coverage of an event, Israeli-Palestinian event, versus the coverage by an Israeli newspaper, Haaretz.
Mm-hmm.
And it found that the New York Times was vastly biased in favor of Israel compared to the Israeli newspaper.
Yeah.
In other words, the Israeli newspaper was more unbiased. You might even look at Haaretz. It's in English and on the web. So there's some very – I mean there's – what a lot of people say about – you go to Israel and say the debate in Israel among Jews is extremely lively and pointed and fuller and richer than it is in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So you may find some of the best sources there. They're all, you know, they're big debates and obviously intense disagreements, and some of the people are going to be wrong, that's for sure.
Sure. I was going to, suggest Haaretz myself. It's Haaretz, Jerry, and you can find it on the web in English. And if you've been reading it recently, four or five columnists, just to give you one side, have been extraordinarily critical of the of all the Israeli attacks on Gaza, not only the ground invasion, but the previous air missile and mortar shelling.
Right, and there'll also be ones in favor of it, of course. But you can also look at, for example, 2006, the attack on Lebanon and Hezbollah, similar sort of thing. So it's impressive that how much a free country Israel remains despite all these problems.
So sometimes you've got to get a fuller and freer debate of the important issues in the Israeli press than you will in the American press. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what this study showed.
Yeah.
I mean, it was comparing. It was not comparing, you know, Podunk Times or something. It was the New York Times versus an Israeli newspaper, not a Palestinian or a Lebanese or something, a paper, or a Turkish paper, but an Israeli one.
Did the study make any
– And he also looks, by the way, at various Haaretz is sort of the left of center and everything.
Yeah.
But he also looked at sort of more extreme wings, including extreme right wings, and you could get, in many cases, better balance there than you could get in the New York Times.
Did the study suggest why the balance was absent in the New York Times?
Well, you have to go into the psychology or the sociology of the newspaper reporting, I guess. But anyway, it's I mean, there's a lot of really sharp journalistic contention going on in Israel.
Sure.
Very much to the country's credit, it seems to me.
Sure. 614-292-8513. Rosemary's here. Hi, Rosemary.
Good morning. Or is it afternoon? I have a question for your guest. You said that why don't we just give up and not do anything? Well, it seems to me that over the years there could have been a lot of things that America could have done. Withdrawing support when Israel insisted on building these settlements on land that's illegal to do that. The Camp David Accords, the ink wasn't dry on the Accords, and they're building these settlements. And we did nothing. I mean, Carter, he complained a little bit, but nothing really significant. Now there may be nothing we can do, But certainly some years back, there certainly, through the years, there's been something, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of people that argue that, including Israelis, that the settlement idea, which goes back 30 years now or more, has been a real disaster. It's been opposed by everybody in the world, including the United States, officially. But they haven't put their, as you suggest, put their money where their mouth is.
No, we have not withheld.
George Bush the First did a little bit on some loan guarantees and stuff, but it's very rare. The argument a lot of people bring up is that the Israel lobby in the United States is part of that, because obviously the Jewish vote is extremely important and so forth. And their argument is that essentially the Israeli lobby, by undercutting American, the possibility America could undercut the settlements, has been very bad for Israel, because Israel now has got itself into this massive dilemma.
Yeah.
They've got the settlements, and they can't, you know, they've been there for a long time now. People are there. The settlers themselves are a force of their own magnitude, and there's a politically very difficult to get out of it.
Well, that's my thought, too. Thank you.
Okay, Rosemary, thanks for your call, 614-292-8513. John, in a recent article you co-authored, you cited a poll that said that 44% of Israelis say they would leave the country if they could find a better standard of living elsewhere. And you say that Israel's concern about nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran potentially, that Israel's future as a Jewish state could be imperiled as a result. You said they could cease to exist as a coherent Jewish state. And you cite the possibility of substantial emigration from Israel. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that's not because that Iran would get nuclear weapons, but the fear and the hype that's coming out of Israel over that could cause people to leave. There's a co-authored by a guy named Ian Lustig, who's an Israeli specialist, Middle East specialist at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was using a lot of his numbers there. And what he's saying is that since this century, there have been more Israelis emigrating than immigrating, Jews leaving than coming in. And there's a danger from Israel's standpoint, which they're well aware of, that this could accelerate. And they're losing also not only just – they're losing some of the best people, the people they most need. There's about 5.5 million Jews there now. And you can have in the last few years sometimes as much as 30,000 people emigrate each year.
Hmm.
And that's partly made up, however, by people immigrating there. But if the immigration goes down – and the immigration stays the same or gets bigger, you're talking 10 years, about 10% of Israeli Jews leave, and that could have kind of a cascading effect. I don't think that's terribly likely, certainly not certain, but it is a danger, and the danger comes out of these exacerbated, accelerated fears over Iran and Iran's nuclear weapon. I think if Iran does get a nuclear weapon, it'll use it like everybody else has, which is to deter and to stoke its own ego. So it is not really very much of a threat, it seems to me, to Israel. Mm-hmm. Though I would be perfectly very happy to have them to see Iran not get the weapon.
Sure. Yeah. But you're saying there are exaggerated fears in Israel of what Iran would do if it gets nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it's almost hysterical. I think I use that word in there, and so does Ian. There's a lead article by Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic about last May, which is Israel's 60th anniversary, April, May. He's very sympathetic to Israel and so forth, but he also cites this hysteria, and to the point where people simply say Israel can't live with a nuclear Iran. And that is totally unexamined, that proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that's nonsense. It can live with it. I mean, Iran might get a few nuclear weapons. It's not clear they would, actually. But if they do, they're going to be surrounded by an alliance, effective alliance, that has tens of thousands of them, with Israel and the United States, and for that matter, Russia, joining in. The idea that they'd use them is incredibly unlikely, it seems to me.
Is it clear that there's a relationship between the more educated classes of Jews leaving Israel and these fears?
No, it would be that the people who leave are the people who can leave most easily. There's a certain amount of... the people leaving also tend to be politically probably to the left, but mostly it's a matter of you can get a job someplace, you've got family.
Yeah.
There's a large number of Israeli Jews who have been able to get European passports because of their grandfather or their father or whatever, particularly German. And so they have those as kind of insurance, as they put it. they're still Israeli citizens. You also have a lot of Jews not really emigrating, but they're leaving. They're not there very much. You know, one of my best friends is at the University of Toronto. He's there half the year, political scientist, very, very fine scholar. And so you get more and more of these people simply not being in Israel, even though they don't give up their Israeli citizenship. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they have to worry about this, what they call a brain drain.
That's mostly economic opportunity, though, you're saying in this case.
Well, no, it's a question. Well, I'll give you an example, and this may sort of illustrate it pretty well. It certainly struck home to me. I was sharing a cab with an Israeli at a political science conference coming in from the airport, and this is in the 90s. This is not during, you know, really bad times. This is a fairly good time. And he had an offer from New Zealand, and he was thinking of taking it. And the way he put it was, I don't know, this is where I want to raise my children, Israel. Hmm. And so it's just human. It's not, he's not, you know, he wants her to be in Israel. He's Jewish. He believes in all that stuff, and, you know, that's his home, et cetera. But and if it was just him and his wife, you know, they'd say, okay, you know, we're adults. We made this decision. If it's dangerous, there's a problem. You know, we're grown up. But when you have your children, I mean, you're responsible for your children. And what was affecting him in particular, just the military service. At that time, there wasn't any kind of real conflict going on. And just the idea that you raise your kid to be 17 or 18 and have to spend a whole bunch of time in the military, whereas if you were in Detroit or, you know, Columbus or Austin or London or something, you'd raise your kids and they'd go to college. That's what they'd do. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't necessarily be in the military. And again, we're not talking about being killed or anything. It's just a matter of, you know, what seems to be a big waste of years on the part of these young people, unless, of course, they really want to go into the military, which would be a whole different thing. But they're they have to. And so the question is, do I want to raise my kid so that when they're 18 years old, they spend half their life at a checkpoint, checking the Palestinians coming back and forth and so forth, which is A, incredibly boring work, and B, at least somewhat dangerous because somebody could possibly eventually set off a bomb. So you're worried about your kids. Anyway, it's that kind of thing. It's just very humid. Yeah. It's not that people are saying, I don't think we should have a Jewish state anymore. It's not that they stop being Jewish, that they may or may not be religious, that they, they believe, you know, the idea of having a Jewish homeland is a great idea and so forth. It's just that this very human sort of thing is, these are my kids. Mm-hmm. And raising them.
In the article, you and your co-author suggest that if Israel were to undertake a bombing of Iranian nuclear installations, the ones that are known to exist, that this would be very counterproductive for Israel.
Yeah, the best evidence for when Israel bombed Iraq, which is 1981, Osirik, they bombed a reactor there, is that there was potentially making bombs for Saddam Hussein. The best evidence is that it speeded up Iraq's program.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would happen with Iran as well. Things would be more dispersed underground, and they don't have a nuclear weapons program yet, essentially, though they're developing the fissile material that could be used for one. And I think if they're bombed, that would accelerate that program.
So, exactly, the opposite of what Israel would like.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it would accelerate that development. We're going to take a – callers, hang on the line. We're going to break here. We're with John Mueller, who holds the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at OSU's Mershon Center, and he's professor of political science here. His latest book, Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. Back after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Things getting a little tense at work?
I'm clicking!
Don't let a busy day get the best of you.
Okay, forget it.
Even when you're busy, day-to-day keeps you informed with what's happening in the world. And we even let you have a little fun.
It's great.
Make the most of your time.
A million things I can do.
Join us for NPR's Day-to-Day.
And on Day to Day this afternoon, what do you do when unemployment reaches double digits? Hear how one community right here in Ohio is responding. That story is coming up on Day to Day, which begins at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get the update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up with the current events or listen to a story you missed. Don't miss a beat with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to our website, wosu.org/email, Taking a look at the weather forecast, a winter weather advisory remains in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Expect areas of freezing rain mixing with sleet. And then as temperatures begin to rise this afternoon, it'll turn into just rain and a high of 35. For tonight, rain is likely and cloudy skies, a low of 34. And for tomorrow, a chance of light rain showers, maybe a snow shower, and cloudy skies and a high of 34. Currently 31 degrees. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line, the WOSU 820 NPR News, talking about challenges for U.S. Foreign and security policy with OSU Professor of Political Science John Mueller at 614-292-8513. You can email short comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. And our caller here is Karen. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I was watching on PBS last night a wonderful program on the history of India. And they had a similar thing.
That was on during the football game, you know.
Well, now you know where I live.
You got your priorities worked out.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, this king, it was during a time when there was much warring and much trying to take over this portion and that portion. And this king had come upon this one other kingdom, and he slaughtered so many. And he looked around and suddenly had a different perception and realized how dreadful all of this was that had just happened. And he became nonviolent. He realized that the only way that everyone could get along was to realize their oneness, because we're all created out of the same. And he became nonviolent, and he took his ideas around governing peoples and nonviolence, and yes, it was exceptionally early, and it probably didn't work very well, but he went from kingdom to kingdom and spread it all over the place, the idea of looking at each other as the same. And I'm thinking, like you had said, where maybe we ought to just leave them alone. Maybe we ought to just let them get to a point to where they feel they've hit bottom. And then someone from their ranks, from their own perspective, their own point of view, is going to step up and say, you know, this has not worked. It's not working. We're not going to do it like this anymore. Because if we have anything, we have free will. And they're not ready.
Hmm.
I thought they would be ready when, oh, I don't know, maybe it was last year or the year before, some bomb went off and some man's baby was killed. So now we were no longer talking strictly about soldiers. We were talking about children, families, communities, where all they're doing is like baking bread and trying to, you know, raise vegetables and things like that. But that didn't work.
Yeah. I mean, there have been children killed on both sides. You know, yesterday a Hamas missile hit a kindergarten classroom in southern Israel, fortunately, which had been evacuated. And we know children are being killed in the Israeli incursion, and children have been killed by suicide bombers in Israel. So, John, there's something to what I guess our caller suggests, that when two populations get ready to work a different way, maybe they can be helped.
Yeah, well, that's what you keep waiting for in the Arab-Israeli situation, and it's not clear. We've been waiting for that for a long time. I think that was the idea initially, that basically when Israel was founded in the late 40s, the idea is that obviously there's a big problem here, and there's no way, you know, if you create a Jewish state, there's going to be a problem. If you don't create a Jewish state, there's going to be a problem. So they created Israel. And I assume that people were generally thinking, well, this can take, you know, some years to work out, but eventually it'll be maybe 10 years, maybe even 20. The idea is still going on after 60 years. And, you know, sometimes these disputes can just last forever. And eventually, I think the caller is right, eventually there's sort of an exhaustion effect and things do get settled. And frequently when it's over, people say, you know, why was that happening?
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the Cold War, I've got a film in which there's one of the guards at former guards at the wall. And he's talking about the night when they, you know, the November night when they finally just let the East Berliners go to West Berlin anytime they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're flowing through, he says, "Why have I been standing at this wall all this time, keeping these people from doing what they want to do?"
Yeah.
I mean, such a simple sort of human thing. Now, frequently that happens. It's just these disputes can also last a fantastic long time. It's not only this one, but obviously the one in Kashmir between India and Pakistan, where they're fighting over a glacier, for God's sake, partly. And it just keeps going on and on and on.
I just wonder if there are any, if in terms of the peace settlement in Northern Ireland, whether there was that quality of exhaustion between Catholics and Protestants in which they finally said, look, this is hopeless. We've got to do it a different way.
Yeah, if they can do that. It's most people think that way already. I mean, most of the violence is carried out by very small numbers of people. And in many respects, and there, you know, there's lots of polls over the years in both Israel and in Palestinian areas in which you get 60, 70, 80% agree with the usual sort of two-state solution, all that
sure.
kind of stuff. The problem is it's only 60, 70, or 80%. It's not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a vote, the vote in Northern Ireland about the peace thing was 95% of the people voted for the peace. I mean, 95%. You can't.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can't get any better.
Never heard an American election where anything got 95%. Same in Algeria. There was also a vote, you know, finally, it was like 95, 98% of the people voted for it. So the vast majority are fed up with this. And the problem is the small numbers of people can keep it going. One thing that does happen is that violence tends to discredit itself so that if Hamas continues, more and more people, and you don't get overreaction to it, you may find that it's counterproductive from Hamas's standpoint. That happened with the Muslim extremists in Algeria, for example.
Mm-hmm. They became so violent that the population turned against them.
Yeah, and the same thing within Iraq. I mean, the reason people turn against Iraq, the al-Qaeda types, is because of their excesses. And so the Iraqi people, the Sunnis, they have one of the big reasons for the change there is they've changed their position on that and have gone after the al-Qaeda types because they're worse than the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
From their standpoint,
yeah. All right, let us go to our next caller here, and yeah, that is Fred. Hello, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I think one of the problems in the academics is that the people are sort of depersonalized and it becomes sort of cold non-entities like cars and trucks and objects. The problem is identifying that in Ireland, Catholics accepted Protestants living next door, and Protestants accepted Catholics living next door. So you weren't creating a Protestant-free state or a Catholic-free state. In India, the Muslims kicked out the Hindus, and the Hindus came back in the 15th century. When the British divided it, the Muslims kicked out all the Hindus, but the Hindus kept the Muslims, even though a lot of Muslims were kicked out. Same with Israel. We're not talking about a two-state solution. In Israel, you've got 1.1 million Muslims, 600,000 Israel voluntarily let in, 1952. Muslims don't voluntarily let in Jews. Basically, it's a sequential destruction of Israel, starting with a Juden-free state that holds all of the strategic assets. In the 4,000-year history of that area, that the people control the Judean hills, ultimately wind up controlling the plains. That's why Moses came through the east. So there are very few people that object to a two-state solution. But the objection is that like Hamas and even in al-Fatah, and what we don't discuss, there are a large segment of Muslims who believe in Dar al-Salam that says once a Muslim rules an area, it can never be ruled by a non-Muslim and must be taken by force. And until that dominance in education is addressed, we're not going to have peace. And what the West has failed in doing was the West plays dirty politics. It gives psychopaths and extortionists and thieves money and armies and weapons for stability. Arafat. You know what Arafat was called by the Palestinians? It was called the outsider.
Well, Fred, do you have a question now for our guest?
Well, the question is, why can't we change and be a little bit more honest about our understanding and demand of people that a two-state solution cannot be something where one religion is cannot live there.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure. The argument would be that you'd have two countries living side by side in a certain amount of respect and hopefully peace and security. And they'd be based on different religions. You'd also have respect for religion, not the main religion, but respect for other religions within each of the two areas. The Western Europe used to be harshly divided between Catholic and Protestant states, and they spent a lot of time killing each other, but that eventually got resolved. There's no particular reason what to think why that can't be resolved in this particular case. Mm-hmm. What the Arabs and Muslims say is that 20% or so of Jewish Israelis want to take over at least the West Bank and maybe much further and go back to the biblical idea of what the Promised Land totally was. And they're totally devoted to that idea. And so that they have basic expansionary ideas as well.
So you'd hope that over time, if you could get to a two-state solution, that religious tolerance would reign as it has, as you point out, in Europe after some
centuries. It only took a few hundred years in Europe.
Yeah.
A thousand.
Yeah. Thanks for your call. And Mary is next. Hello, Mary.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I just have one question, and I'll take it off the air. But I know in Israel there is a hospital there called Hadassah, which has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize because they are like an island of peace. They treat anybody who walks through their doors without whether they have a dime or a shekel in their pocket, and this includes any Arabs, Muslims, Christians, secular, whoever they may be.
Mm-hmm.
They've done liver transplants for Palestinian children. All sorts of things like that, and they have clinics in Palestinian, areas in the West Bank and all. I'm just wondering if anything like this exists in the Arab world where, anybody is treated no matter, who they are. I mean, I know Hadassah is basically supported by the Israeli government and about 300,000 women in this country and Jewish women predominantly in this country, and they've done so much to try to bring peace through good health care and education, and you walk through their halls and you see Palestinian Muslims sitting next to Jews waiting in the intensive care unit, their mm-hmm. children playing together in the children's unit. Is there anything like that in the Arab world where they're trying to bring everybody together in some manner to show that they want they want to be able to live.
Oh, I understand. John, what do we know about that?
You need a sort of specialist in the area to really look at it. I mean, hospitals generally tend to take whoever walks in the door. They don't spend a lot of time looking at ID cards and everything.
Yeah.
The ability to help for people to help other people when they're in need is very high, and it doesn't necessarily follow any sort of class or ethnic or religious line much of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think Mary, you would, as we say, need an area specialist to answer your specific question as to whether there is such an institution in Palestinian areas.
Yeah, of course, there are not very many Jews in the Palestinian area.
Yeah, so there's not much opportunity to have such an institution. Thanks, Mary. Thanks for your call. Eric is here. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Yes, I have a. Well, I have a friend who was Jewish when I was an undergraduate, and she explained to me something about the whole situation over there that I didn't ever understand too well. And that was that when the Jewish state was founded, the Palestinians were told, promised by their Arab neighbors, come on over, get out of there, clear the area, we're going to roll Israel back into the ocean, we'll kill them all, whatever. And, of course, it didn't happen. I mean, these scrappy Jewish fighters won that battle. They won that initial war, and they won all the wars ever since. Great. Kudos to them. But is there an animosity or a resentment between the Palestinian refugees that are in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and the countries, the governments there who promised them this and then couldn't fulfill that promise? And we're talking 60 years on now. There's got to be a resentment of the resources that these Palestinians sap out of their, the coffers of those nations. Mm. What is the politics between the Palestinians in the refugee camps and such and the populations of those countries themselves?
Yeah, well, it's there's work by the Israeli historian Benny Morris, which indicates that the way the Arabs left, the Arabs, to say the least, were strongly encouraged by Israeli forces to leave. It wasn't just simply that they were being seduced by other Arab regimes, or they went under their own free will just because of general fears. There was a conscious effort to basically force them out, so he's been several books and works on that. Benny Morris is the guy's name. On the other hand, the other part of the thing is just about this. The reason I think it's hopeless is that you actually have people there saying, I was kicked out, whatever their reasons are, I was kicked out of Israel 60 years ago and I want to go back. They want to go back to their old village. Well, their old village is probably a parking lot now, but they still want to go back. And so what you're dealing with is a sort of a romantic idea. I mean, these people saying this weren't even alive 60 years ago when this happened, and it's still there. But the whole issue is based on this romanticism. The whole idea of Israel is probably the most romantic idea ever, that there should be a Jewish state in that particular area of the world because there was a Jewish state there 2,500 years ago. I mean, you can understand the force of that story and everything, but it is like a totally romantic idea. Or a dream, as the Israelis frequently use that word. So what you're dealing with is romantics. And I have a lot of trouble with romantics, I must say. Monsters I can deal with a lot easier than I can deal with romantics because, if you're in love with an idea and so forth, and it's a perfectly understandable thing. You know, this is where my homeland was, et cetera, and I got the Bible explains where Abraham was buried, et cetera. It's perfectly understandable. It's just very hard to say, you got to give up that dream, particularly when, there's been now 60 years of success of establishing at least part of it.
What is the relationship what do we know between Palestinians in Lebanon and other surrounding countries, in refugee camps, et cetera? I mean, between them and their hosts.
Oh, it's been various. I mean, right now, there's the idea of giving Gaza back to Egypt. Egypt used to control Gaza. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptians don't want them back at all. The Jordanians could take back the West Bank, for example, and they are able to contain their enthusiasm big time for that. In 1970, there were a large number of Palestinians who lived in Jordan, and they were kicked out after some terrorist events and so forth by the Jordanians. They went to them and went to Lebanon. They frequently do not find a huge amount of welcome in places where they've gone either, within the Arab world.
Mm-hmm. All right, Eric, thanks for your questions. And let's move on a bit here to another challenging situation here. We've had, a record number of foreign troops killed in Afghanistan in 2008 combating the Taliban. And the United States is planning to send, apparently, press reports say 20,000 extra troops to Afghanistan in the next 12 to 18 months. Good idea, bad idea. I mean, Afghanistan, of course, has proven a morass previously for the Soviet Union, who suffered great losses and then left after attempting to occupy and control it. What are some of our policy options here?
One of them is get out. Go back to where I started here with a different issue. Mm-hmm. Give up. Anthony Cordesman was at Mershon Center about 6 months ago giving a talk. He's one of the top military analysts in Washington. And he was looking at the not only the Afghan situation, but also the connected Pakistan situation. And he kept talking about all the trends and so forth, and they were all bad. So I asked him then, the logic of what you're saying is it's hopeless, right? And he said, oh, no, we have to keep, plugging away. So you get that. Obama, of course, has been committed throughout the campaign to say Iraq was the wrong place and Afghanistan is the right place. But the problems in Afghanistan, if you talk to some of the people who've been in both places, they say, wow, Iraq was a piece of cake compared to this one. You've got, the warlords, you've got an extremely unpopular government, increasingly unpopular government, and also an extreme, because it's so incompetent and often vicious, not necessarily the, Karzai, but many of the, people on down. You've got Taliban that can just keep doing this potentially forever, this harassment. The basic policy is that in order to build up Afghanistan, what we have to do is destroy its only industry, which is opium. It would be like trying to rebuild Iraq by capping the oil wells. So what we're doing is trying to destroy the economy of the main part of the economy of the country, the biggest thing by far. and at the same time trying to rebuild it. And no one is pointing that out. I mean, some people thought, well, maybe we can buy it and then put it into morphine and use it in hospitals and stuff like that. You know, a few ideas like that.
Is that at all practical?
I don't think so. No, I think it's just a monumental problem. If it were legal, I mean, and the point is that the reason we're trying to stop opium and production there is because we use too much of it here.
Yeah.
Or in Western Europe. Actually, most of their stuff goes to Western Europe. And so my answer is, well, then stop the people in the United States and Western Europe from using it. You know, it's a really bad thing. You know, like, remember tobacco. Remember that? Or excessive use of alcohol. In other words, stop the users, not stop the source. There was an Afghan guy here, also at Mershon, sort of ambassador, sub-ambassador from Afghanistan. And I said to him, you know, well, the United States, you know, exports a lot of tobacco and liquor. And it's pointed out that tobacco particularly kills large numbers of people. And then when you tell that to the Americans, they say, well, tell them not to smoke then. Couldn't you say that with respect to, you know, the poppies, et cetera? And he sort of smiled. Of course, he did not. Being a diplomat, he was certainly not going to agree with that proposition. But the idea that we have to destroy Afghanistan because we're using too much opium in Western Europe and the United States is really impressive. It's not. I tried to look up, trying to get the numbers. You had a really good talk also at Mershon recently from a BBC guy who's been looking into the opium thing in Afghanistan. And it could be that the amount of money that a legitimate government could make from the opium trade, the taxes and so forth, which would then be controlled, it wouldn't be a criminal activity. For example, in Colombia, cocaine is criminal. And the government doesn't make any money from it, and coffee is legal, and they make tons of money from that. So, you know, there's a big difference. Anyway, if you legalized it, then what would happen would be that the government could make money. It could very well possibly make more money from the opium trade than it gets from all the aid from the United States and Western Europe combined. Not quite sure about those figures, but it's a possibility. So you got basically destroying the economy of the country while trying to rebuild it. You've got the warlords, you've got the Taliban, you've got this corrupt government. How do you fix that? You've got this huge amount of territory to cover. And so it just seems to be extraordinarily difficult to see how there's any way out of that.
Hmm. What is there a significant security reason in terms of the United States, John, that we need to maintain this and increase our troop presence there? In other words, what's this? If we were simply to leave, what's the drawback in terms of our security? And I mean, people say, well, if you leave, international terrorists will establish bases there. They will be protected. They'll be able to plot more efficiently. So you can't leave. I mean, that's one argument.
That certainly is an argument. It's totally accepted, as far as I can see, by 99.999% of all the policymakers. And maybe Obama. I doubt if Obama's going to get anybody else saying the opposite, even though he's out for different points of view. It's basically, you know, the base for the 9/11 attack was Hamburg, Germany. That's where they figured it out and worked it out, right? They don't really need a base. Al-Qaeda basically consists of about 150 people running around in the hills of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then a bunch of jihadists who sort of link up on the internet and try to dare each other to do something. The total number of people killed by Al-Qaeda since 9/11, Al-Qaeda wannabes, Al-Qaeda maybes, Al-Qaeda whatevers, outside of war zones since 9/11 is between 200 or 300 per year. It's not a major threat or an existential threat. If it becomes bigger, they're mostly going to be focused presumably on that area anyway. The people who lose in all this, no matter what happens, seems to me, are the Afghan people, mm-hmm. whether the United States stays or whether the United States leaves.
So in other words, you see no significant security drawback for the United States in simply leaving Afghanistan?
No, the only interest, it seems to me, is humanitarian.
Yeah.
I mean, the Afghan people have been through hell since 1979 when the Soviets invaded. Hell sometimes of their own making, sometimes of foreigners' making. And the idea of having them still continue that is hard to swallow, but it's purely humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. I've never been able to stand, as you say, 99.9% of analysts and advisors seem to say, well, you know, we have a strong security interest in being in Afghanistan, and I've never quite been able to figure out why there's such unanimity of opinion about that.
Well, it makes two of us there, right, Fred? I can't figure it out either. It's happening. What's happening is that, we may be the vanguard, you and me, Fred, because within Western Europe, for example, there's no enthusiasm for increasing troops, even though they've been committed, particularly the Germans, since the day one, since 2001. and sending more troops, maybe some more money or something, but not more troops is just not there. And that may also affect the United States. People more and more saying there isn't any security interest in there. Why are we in there? And let's get out, which is, you know, what happened with Somalia or with Lebanon earlier, or ultimately with Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a possibility, and that's going to be happening gradually during Obama's watch, mm-hmm. And maybe coming disproportionately from his own party.
All right. Hi, Marie. You're on the air with us.
Professor Mueller made some statement that we could not buy the opium and make it into medicines here. And I'd appreciate it if he would expand on why not. And I will hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not looking into it carefully. And there's a French group that actually advocates that. But when I talked to this guy from the BBC about it, the practical difficulties of buying that much were very high. And in addition, if you did do that, they just produce more so that the drug market would basically continue. You wouldn't really swallow it up. In addition, by the way, another thing is that even if you are able to stop the opium production within Afghanistan, other places will grow more of it. So it won't help with the drug problem at all. In fact, the Taliban did that. In 1 year, they cut opium production. I think it was 2000 year. They cut opium production to like zero. I mean, they really – because every mullah in the area was saying, those look like poppies there in that field, right? And so the farmer – oh, yeah, I guess that's a poppy. So they had this policing system so that they cut it massively to almost nothing. And what happened is people started growing it in Pakistan or in Iran or other places, and the market to Western Europe and the United States stayed pretty much the same. So that even if you were successful in Afghanistan – stopping it wouldn't solve the drug problem within the West. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think the practical thing is that even if what that would do is basically you'd buy up a bunch of the stuff, but you couldn't buy all of it up. And furthermore, they could do both. They could, okay, we'll take your money and then we'll grow it and sell it also, you know, to New York or mm-hmm. to Paris or whatever.
So in other words, if you took the total, if you legalized opium poppy growing in Afghanistan, if the government of Afghanistan legalized it, and then we came along and say we're going to buy the entire crop as much as you can get to us, and we'll use it for morphine and other such legal drugs.
Yeah, but it's not a finite thing. You know, you can grow one hell of a lot of poppies if you want.
You can
so buying the whole thing is not – the point is if you could basically exhaust the whole country, every single poppy-growing field,
yeah.
maybe. But that's not the case because they can always grow more. And if they don't grow more there, they can grow more in Pakistan or in Iran or other places.
Yeah. So the only problem you solve that, you would solve an economic problem for Afghanistan, I guess.
That's right. The issue is if the government took it over. Well, that's a way of pumping the money in. But the thing is, it wouldn't solve the drug problem particularly, no. And they would still. So it doesn't. You might, if you can do that, you might as well just give the money directly to the Afghan government
and give it in more productive ways for infrastructure projects and other such things.
Yeah, well,
perhaps.
If they don't get keep being blown up, or if they aren't being the money isn't being embezzled by corrupt officials. Yes.
Yeah. Apparently, Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent, now working for an NGO in Afghanistan, and also a New York Times article talked recently about the horrific corruption at all levels of the Afghan government.
Yeah, we had somebody from
everybody.
Somebody from NPR talking about that, Mershon, about six, 8 months ago, and that was her main thing. She showed a picture of one of these government officials, which is basically a thug sent to this town, and he basically extorting the town.
Yeah. John Mueller holds the Woody Hayes
Chair. And not providing protection.
And not providing protection, yeah. Holds the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at OSU's Mershon Center, professor of political science. My guest's most recent book, Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. Thanks again, John Mueller, for being here.
Thank you. Summer. Nice to be here.
News is next on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. Streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.